Welcome, Unknown Country subscribers. We are following up a Dreamland interview between Nick Bryant and Whitley Strieber on Nick's new book, The Franklin Scandal, a story of power brokers, child abuse, and betrayal. My reaction to hearing the Dreamland and to reading Nick's book is, well, the whole thing is soul shriveling is the expression that I gave it, because that's pretty much what it is. If you've heard the Dreamland interview, and I'm sure you have, you'll know what we're talking about. We're talking about child abuse on a massive scale. We're talking about a well-documented series of abuses of pedophilia that has taken place at the highest government levels in Washington, D.C. and around the country. This is a scandal that has been talked about for years. This is one of those things that crops up constantly, and you think maybe it's an internet hoax, or you think it's something too wild, too obscure, too strange, that it can't possibly be true. And then you pick up Nick's book, and you look at the massive amount of documentation that exists. You look at the names that are mentioned. You look at the FBI files that have been declassified. You look at all of the police reports and everything else, and you come away with this sickening feeling that there is something very dark and very wrong at the heart of this country. Nick, welcome to the subscriber interview.
Thanks, Peter.
It's a pleasure for me to be able to talk to you. We've spoken before on and off. We were like ships passing in the night, I think.
We've
covered some of the same material, but from different angles. And there's a number of things that you were not able to discuss in the Dreamland interview that I would like to be really sure that we cover here. A couple of things. Of course, you mentioned Boys Town. There's a long chapter on the role of Boys Town in this in your investigation and in this scandal in general. This is the thing that people are just not going to be able to deal with. I mean, this is Father Flanagan, right? This is Bing Crosby in the movie, isn't it? I mean, we're talking about, you know, an icon of American Christian ideals. And what you're proving in your book is that Boys Town was used as kind of a warehouse or an inventory for pedophiles to source children.
Well, it was certainly used as a recruiting center. I had a real tough time when I first started investigating Franklin. Boys Town came up, and I had a really difficult time with that, because I've always looked upon Boys Town as a utopia for troubled youth. And but as I started delving further and further into Franklin, Boys Town kept coming up more and more. The first first documented case of a child coming forward, a victim coming forward, was Eulise Washington. And she said that she'd been flown to D.C. and also flown to Chicago and also to New York with Boys Town students. And then there were three later victims that came forward, Alicia Owen, Troy Bonner, and Paul Manassi, and they all said that Boys Town kids had been pandered along with them to affluent power brokers. And so there's four corroborations right out of the gate. And but Gary Caradore, the investigator that was hired by the Special Legislative Committee that was looking into Franklin, I have a leads list of his that mentions approximately 60 victims of abuse, and approximately 10 of them were Boys Town students. And I was able to track down three Boys Town students that were on that list, and they basically said that one told me he was a mayor of Boys Town. Every year the student body of Boys Town elected a mayor of Boys Town, which is an incorporated city with its own post office and its own police force. And he told me that he was aware of this pedophile network conscripting Boys Town kids. And then I talked to two kids, Boys Town kids, that said that they've been flown around a number of times to various parties. And then I talked, I found another Boys Town kid. And it's not like I'm putting an ad in the newspapers and randomly finding people. I mean, I've got paperwork directing, connecting this ring to these kids. And then I found another kid who had been molested, he said, by one of the ring's primary pimps about 12 times.
Right. So what we have is, you know, is, I mean, if it gets to Boys Town, I mean, come on, right? We can try to find ways to rationalize so much, but it can only go so far. And if you're talking about Boys Town, then you throw up your hands and you say, well, then, you know, where do we begin with this? Boys Town jumped out at me for another reason too. I don't know if you're aware of it. You probably are, but at one point Charles Manson was at Boys Town. You know, he was there briefly in the late 1940s, I think, which is probably before all of this started, but it just makes you start to wonder. But so we have Boys Town and we have obviously the church, and you know, in the last 10, 15 years or so, there have been so many revelations about pedophilia being almost systemic within the church at some point. But you mentioned a name that I really want to go to because this is one of the unsung heroes of this whole investigation. That's Gary Caradore. What can you tell us, you know, briefly about Gary and his role in this and what he was able to do?
Gary Caradore was an amazing investigator. He had been a distinguished military career, and he also had a distinguished career in the Nebraska State Patrol, which is basically the Nebraska State Police. And he branched out on his own and became a private investigator, and he ran Caracorp, which had about 120 employees. And he was considered one of the best, if not the best investigator in the Midwest, and certainly one of the preeminent private investigators in the country. And the legislative committee ruptured at one point. There was a tremendous amount of pressure put on the legislative committee, and there was a lot of paranoia. And it ruptured, and its first investigator quit, and then they brought on Gary Caradore. And he was a different type of investigator than the first investigator. I mean, Gary Caradore was a guy that hit the streets looking for leads, conscripting confidential informants. And within 2 or 3 months of signing on, he had 3 additional victims videotaped who said that they were part of this pedophile network. And now, Gary Caradore was taking a tremendous amount of heat. I mean, his phones had been tapped. His house had been broken into. When he would arrange meetings over the phone for potential witnesses or victims, FBI agents would show up at the meeting. So he had no doubt that he was going toe-to-toe with the FBI. And it's very obvious from my book that he was. Now, the FBI had told one of the victims, or possibly even more, that if they said Gary Caradore gave them cash and scripts, that they would be scot-free and the FBI would go after Gary Caradore for falsifying his child abuse investigation.
Right.
And Caradore got wind of this from multiple sources, that the FBI was setting him to take the fall for being such a good investigator, for uncovering so much of this pedophile network up. So he kind of felt like pictures were his way to go to prove definitively that there was a pedophile network and that these kids had been abused. And I believe I've got 5 corroborations that he came by pictures in Chicago, and 5. Corroboration. And he never made it back from Chicago to Nebraska. His plane broke up over Lee County, Illinois, and he was killed.
Well, this is something that has led a lot of people to suspect, obviously, that he was murdered. It was an assassination, and that even William Colby, former head of the CIA, was under the impression that Caradori was assassinated.
William Colby stated privately, but not publicly, that Gary Caradori had been assassinated, yes.
What was the relationship between Caradori and Colby? How did Colby even know this was going on?
Colby, it's kind of interesting. Colby knew the head of the Legislative Committee, Lauren Schmidt. They had a friend in common, that being John DeCamp. And
right.
John DeCamp had introduced Colby to Lauren Schmidt some years earlier. And when they were looking to hire a counsel for the Franklin Committee, William Colby's name came up, and actually he flew to Nebraska. And because at this point, the Franklin Committee had gotten wind that this pedophile network was connected with the CIA. And actually, it had been in a Lincoln Journal article that rumors of a CIA affiliation, So there were people on this legislative committee that wanted to hire Colby. And because he felt that Colby could possibly get to the bottom of this, given his connections and being that he was the former head of the CIA. And but ultimately, the people that wanted Colby on the committee lost by a narrow margin, because there were senators on the Franklin Committee that were just dubious of Colby because of his CIA background, and they felt like this pandering network was connected to the CIA and Colby would facilitate a cover-up. So ultimately, Colby's appointment was shot down by, I think it was a 4-3 margin. And but after Caradori got murdered, it was stated very publicly by the chairman of the Special Legislative Committee that Caradori had been assassinated. And actually, I've got an affidavit of his where he says that Caradori had been assassinated. And they hired Colby to investigate Caradori's death. And this is where it gets kind of tricky. I mean, Colby died very mysteriously in 1996. I pretty much show in my book that his murder was not the accident that it's supposed to be. But it's difficult to know why he was murdered. Because he did not, although he told people privately that Gary Caradori had been murdered, and there's at least three people that I'm aware of that he told that to, or possibly even four. He wasn't willing to state it publicly. So it's really difficult to say that Colby's death. A lot of people have tried to link Colby's death to Franklin, and I just don't know.
It
could have been one of many things.
He did appear, of course, in that famous television documentary, Conspiracy of Silence, which is one of the things that makes that so compelling, is that you have the former head of the CIA sort of going on the record and saying there were abuses, of this nature without actually going and talking about Caradori. Is it possible that people were wondering if Colby was going to get religion at one point and just, you know, bear all, reveal everything, since he was getting kind of close with Yorkshire Television for this documentary, and maybe he was, you know, tending in that direction?
Well, in my book, I talk about John DeCamp had met him in Washington, D.C., and Colby was a lifelong Catholic. And according to John DeCamp, and this is surely before Colby died, he had grown disillusioned with the CIA's use and abuse of children. And he had told DeCamp that he wanted to do something about it. And then shortly thereafter, he ends up, he has his very, very, very strange demise. So if what DeCamp is saying is true, it sounded like Colby could have been on a crusade to expose the CIA's use and abuse of children. And that could have led to his death.
I'd like to bring up another name that doesn't appear in your book, but for reasons that will become clear in a second, maybe there's something that our listeners would find very compelling about this. John Paisley. John Paisley had worked for Colby at one point, but Paisley was a high-ranking CIA official who had a predilection for sex parties in Washington, D.C. in the 1970s. We're talking some of the most lurid stuff you can imagine. Now, I haven't been able to find definitive links between Paisley and pedophilia per se, but his participation in a long string of wild parties, and even to the point where he went and purchased a building on a lot to hold these sex parties. I mean, this guy was devoted to this kind of behavior. And for somebody in the CIA with the kind of ranking that he had, especially concerning Eastern Europe desks and everything else and Russia desks, makes this whole thing very mysterious. But Colby and Paisley both died the same way. Paisley died on his boat in the middle of a river. Actually, they found his body later, I believe, weighted down with weights with a shotgun blast to his head, which was ruled a suicide. And in the same stretch of water that Colby was found years later. So, I mean, here's Paisley, you know, also involved in sex parties in Washington, D.C., died under similar circumstances as Colby. And there's been a number of people who died on their boats in that river, including a guy called Merrill and a few other people. They seem to like this particular stretch of water, and they seem to like to tie weights to themselves, as Merrill did in Paisley and everyone else, and shoot themselves and fall overboard. I don't know. It's like a Bermuda Triangle of spooks, but it's just a weird coincidence. And, you know, it also involves the sex parties and all the rest of it.
Well, I mean, Colby's death was very, very strange. I mean, he had he called his wife. Now, I've got different accounts that he had told his wife that he was sick and was going to bed. And there's an account that he was sick and he was going to go canoeing regardless. It's difficult to know. His wife wasn't willing to talk to me. So, but it was a very cold night in April, and he went canoeing, and he left his computer on. He left bowls and dishes on the table. It's very strange. I mean, that's completely out of character with William Colby, who's a very meticulous guy. And then to go out canoeing on a cold, windy night is very, very strange. One of his neighbors was interviewed, and his neighbor said that, you know, Colby never would have gone canoeing on that type of night where it was cold and windy. Now, here's the kicker. With the Colby, so Colby's body went missing for it. His canoe was found, and his body went missing for 8 days, and his body basically resurfaced from where the canoe was found. They supposedly had sonars and divers and dogs, and they were combing the banks and the river. But the Associated Press reported that William Colby didn't have shoes and socks on. So it was like a very cold, windy night, and William Colby left his computer on, left dishes on the table, and then went canoeing without shoes and socks? I mean, it doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't. Well, the Paisley thing didn't make sense, and the other murders that I've been looking at in that area, in that stretch of water in Maryland, it doesn't make sense either. And there's a naval base right there as well, which is... it's off limits to other individuals and stuff. I don't know. It's one of those things where I think it's just a convenient place, you know, to dispose of spooks. I don't know what. I mean, as you say, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Obviously, you know, he was murdered. I mean, there's just no way around it. And if he was murdered, of course, it raises a whole host of questions, and the Franklin scandal comes close to that. One of the things that that always struck me about the Franklin scandal, your book brought up these memories again of the time that I've spent once in a while trying to hook up with the people who are very much involved in the satanic ritual abuse stuff, you know, and the hysteria that surrounds this, and a lot of very troubled people with very strange stories about high-ranking politicians and, you know, sexual abuse taking place and satanic stuff, et cetera, et cetera. And I dismiss that for the most part. I mean, I've attended one of their meetings up in Connecticut some years ago for 2 or 3 days, and that's one of the most bizarre experiences I've had. But suddenly you read the Franklin scandal and you read about Finders and Boys Town, and you put together the pedophilia scandals in the church and among other politicians, and suddenly the whole thing doesn't seem that bizarre anymore. We have so many people making outrageous claims, you know, that they were abused by Henry Kissinger and George Bush, you know, at the same time in a hotel room in, you know, in Offutt Air Force Base, you know, or something. And, you know, obviously, you know, elaborate, impossible-to-believe stuff. And then you come across your book, and suddenly the unbelievable becomes not only believable and credible, but it becomes true. Like a lot of people, I'm sitting here looking at some of the most evil things that you can imagine, and you have a very good approach to the material. It's not a heavily emotional, hysterical approach, but the reaction of your readers is going to be that. They're going to sit down, put the book down, and say, my God, this is awful. This is hideous. You know, all these weird rumors we've heard for so many years now have a kind of a ring of truth. With Finders, you had a satanic cult abusing children, performing sacrifices connected to the CIA, you know. They interviewed the head of that organization, Marion Petty. I don't know if you followed that up.
I have an interview with him, actually.
You
that
do?
That was conducted by the D.C. Alternative Weekly.
Well, he claims, of course, that he's sort of generational CIA, right? That his family had been in the CIA, and, you know,
His wife was CIA.
And that they were been used to do some computer stuff or something for CIA. Remember that thing? But, I mean, once you start to develop these links, even when they try to poo-poo any other kind of connection, you're looking at the government, you're looking at weird rituals, you're looking at transporting children not just across state lines, but across, you know, national boundaries. All of the material that the Metropolitan Police Department came up with, all of the evidence that they found, points to something, you know, unbelievable in its scope. I mean, how were you able to deal with this? How are you able to deal with years of investigating this particular scandal and not find your own soul shriveling, if I might use that expression?
Well, I had to, I realized pretty early on that I was going to have to really try to keep a spiritual stasis throughout this investigation, because I've gone into some very dark, dark, dark corridors, both physically and emotionally, with this story. And I've certainly taken a lot of heat with it, too. So I just felt a lot of times in life you don't know exactly what the right thing to do is. And a lot of times in life you know exactly what the wrong thing to do is. But a lot of times in life you just don't know exactly what the right thing to do is. And I really believe, and I've written a lot in children's issues, when I realized that this was a reality, I just felt like exposing it was categorically the right thing to do. And that's what gave me a lot of strength to keep going throughout this investigation, is because the government shouldn't be aiding and abetting industrial child abuse. And that's what I firmly believed then, and that's what I firmly believe now. So I never, it wasn't one of those situations where I felt ambivalent, like I could be doing the wrong thing. And that gives one a tremendous amount of strength.
Well, when you talk about the institutionalized sort of child abuse, and you've discussed this with Whitley also in the Dreamland interview, I wonder if there's an institution within our society and our government in Washington, wherever, where this is not only accepted but encouraged to the extent that it has been, if they're capable of that with children, were they capable of other things with children? We know from anecdotal evidence and from scattered pieces of trace evidence leading back to, you know, the Kennedy assassination, and that there were secret schools in Mexico, particularly. Arthur Mullins, I think, one of the people suspected of having links to Lee Harvey Oswald, who was with him on the bus going into Mexico, for instance, is known to have been involved in one of these secret schools training children as assassins. There's been evidence linking him to that. And he was also a religious, or posing as a religious leader. So again, you have, you know, a secret school, you have children in Mexico, you have a religious leader, quote unquote. You have government involvement potentially. Is the Franklin scandal the tip of an iceberg? Is there something else going on of which we are not aware? I mean, what is your sense in talking to these people? Because you've spoken to the victims, and that alone must be pretty harrowing. But is there a sense there was anything else going on beyond the pedophilia?
Well, my thoughts on it are, if you're willing to use and abuse children as sadistically as these children were used and abused, the sky's the limit as far as evil. I mean, I think that the most evil act that one can do is destroy the life of a child. And pockets of the government are certainly aiding and abetting this. And I'm not saying that, like, the entire FBI is corrupt or the entire CIA is corrupt.
Of course not.
But I'm saying that there is a subgenus within the law enforcement, within federal law enforcement, that is very, very corrupt. And I think that I really hit home with this when I show that the U.S. magistrate that helped cover up Franklin, he's now he got bumped up to a U.S. judge. He's a sitting judge, U.S. district judge with a lifetime appointment. Now, the assistant U.S. prosecutor that helped cover up Franklin, he's now a U.S. magistrate. And Omaha is in Douglas County. And one of the Douglas County deputy attorneys that helped cover this up, that helped prosecute or persecute Alicia Owen, he's now an assistant U.S. attorney. Now, they were all bumped up. The cover-up went down under the administration of George Herbert Walker Bush. But these, all three guys, were bumped up under the Clinton administration. So there seems to be this perfidiousness, this corruption within the federal judiciary, within the federal law enforcement. And it's just not a function of, like, the Bush administration, a cover-up under the Bush administration. I mean, these three guys were bumped up under the Clinton administration. So in my book, I make one of the arguments I make for the system being very corrupt is that these judicial officers were promoted under Clinton, even though what they helped cover up was a mess that the Bush administration was trying to deal with.
So basically, we're just exchanging figureheads, and the system remains the same.
The system remains the same. A corrupt subgenus within the system that has a tremendous amount of power, that has the power to make truths lies and to make lies truths. I mean, if you look at the breathtaking federal firepower that was involved in covering up Franklin, it was much more than what was involved with the Finders, because Franklin was getting exposed in D.C. by the Washington Times, and it was getting exposed in Nebraska by the Legislative Committee and Gary Caradore. So you ultimately had three grand juries, two in Nebraska and one in Washington, D.C., that were hijacked to cover up Franklin. Now, that is breathtaking power, to be able to hijack three grand juries.
I mean, absolutely.
It's amazing. I mean, the milieu of a grand jury is basically, if the special prosecutor is corrupt, you can easily hijack a grand jury. But the fact that they had to get three grand juries hijacked is just, I just find it mind-boggling. And then call in markers with the media. I mean, the media, through either the national media, we're talking New York Times, Washington Post, through either omission or commission, was very responsible in covering up Franklin. CBS, too. So the firepower that was brought to vaporize Franklin, it's actually quite mind-boggling when you think about it.
Well, it's funny because we've been doing a series of interviews lately that have touched upon issues like secrecy and the abuse of secrecy and the abuse of information by the national security apparatus. I had an interview recently with Richard Dolan, who wrote UFOs in the National Security State, of how, you know, our conversation has nothing to do with UFOs, but it's the same idea that the government has this power through the use of secrecy, through the use of covering up and suppressing information, to actually create a fictitious reality for the rest of us. You know, by using secrecy, they're able to give us a picture of the world which is not true, which is not real. We're not allowed to think about Franklin and its implications, just as we're not allowed to think about, you know, cover-up regarding UFO experiences. I mean, people are having these experiences, whether it's seeing a UFO or an alien on the one hand, or whether it's having been abused by a politician on the other, and they are considered uncredible, you know, not credible as witnesses and not people that we should listen to and pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Your book is so well documented, as Dolan's book is on the UFO thing, that if you put all this evidence together, you begin to realize that there is a level of control over reality, control over our perceptions of what is true and what is not true, what is real and what is not real, that is, as you put it, mind-boggling, breathtaking in scope. And we're supposed to not believe this, you know. We're told, oh, the government couldn't keep anything a secret, you know. You can't have two people in the government knowing something because a third will find out. I mean, you hear all of these stories, and it's not quite true, is it? They can quash information. They can quash an entire line of investigation to something so heinous, you would think there would be one voice in the Senate, one voice in the House, one voice in the Department of Justice somewhere who's going to insist that this comes out, and yet it doesn't happen.
Well, I think with Franklin, the Franklin scandal, I do show that there is a blackmail apparatus with our politicians. And, I mean, last October, the October before this last one, the congressional approval rating was 12%.
Right.
That means that 88% of Americans felt like the U.S. Congress was not acting in their best interest. 88% of Americans.
Right.
How does this happen? And if you look at politicians, there are three things that make people, smart people, really stupid. One is sex, one is greed, and I think the third one is arrogance. And I think the arrogance makes people susceptible to being stung by sex or greed. I mean, Bill Clinton is a perfect example of it. But a lot of our politicians have the trifecta of they're sex addicts, they're greedy, and they're arrogant. And given that trifecta, they would be quite easy to compromise. I mean, it's you just don't need little boys or girls compromise a politician. I mean, a young man in his early 20s could definitely sink a politician for sure. Or if the politician is married, an extramarital affair will sink the politician. Or taking money in some scheme or another can sink a politician. So there are multiple ways to compromise a politician. And according to my investigation with Franklin, I've kind of come to the conclusion that if a politician can be compromised, they probably are compromised.
But then it raises the question.
Commentary.
It raises the question then as to who's doing all this compromising and to what end. Has the country become better for all of this? Have we improved ourselves? Obviously, if that was the agenda, you know, they failed miserably. So who's doing this and who benefits from all this intense blackmail and compromising of our elected officials? I mean, you know, well, who's sitting back there getting the benefit? Cui bono, as they say in legalese.
I think, as I said earlier, I think that there is a very corrupt subgenus within the government. But there is a politician who I believe is compromised, and he was the main cheerleader with the bailout. So ultimately, you've got as soon as I saw that he was involved with the bailout, I just felt like it stank. So you have an a compromised politician, or a politician that I truly believe is compromised, leading the way for the bailout for these various financial institutions to get billions and billions and billions of dollars. So I think that you've got a corrupt subgenus within the government, and there is certainly a corrupt subgenus within the financial strata, the business world. And I think that there is probably a tremendous amount of collusion between the two. And in my book, I certainly demonstrate that there's a corrupt subgenus within the federal government. And the fact that a compromised politician is so assiduously going to bat for the bailout, I mean, just proved to me that there was this interaction between these two corrupt entities.
So it just comes down to money? Is that really what this is all about?
Well, money and power. I mean, you need a lot of power. Money and power are sometimes synonymous and sometimes they're not.
Well, what I'm getting at is, you know, how does this affect, for instance, our foreign policy? I mean, you know, the country is in such bad shape. I mean, what's the point of having power in a country that's, you know, that is in such a turmoil? And if these people have created this turmoil, if, you know, have they? I mean, I guess that's my question. And, you know, what does Iraq have to do with it, if anything? I mean, we have this power, this corrupt subgenus, as you mentioned, within the government, that everybody seems to be obeying because they have no choice, because they have been so compromised. Does this affect things beyond simply the functioning of our own individual country? Does it affect other things? Is it more widespread? Is it international in scope? I don't know. Maybe you can't answer these questions, but these are the things that occur to me after reading your book.
Well, you know, I think that there are some business entities in Iraq that have made a tremendous amount of money.
Well, like Blackwater, for instance, and
Halliburton. It's kind of interesting where you've got kind of a nexus between Franklin matters and also the military-industrial complex is the DynCorp scandal in Eastern Europe. DynCorp is a military contractor, much like Halliburton. And they were running their own pedophile network in Eastern Europe. That was basically pandering children to DynCorp executives. So you do see that nexus with DynCorp in Eastern Europe between government contractors, foreign policy, and an element of and child trafficking. But with the Iraq War, and also, I think, with the Afghan war, there are some people that have made just unbelievable amounts of money off of that war. And
there was a scandal recently, wasn't there, concerning Blackwater and pedophilia and charges of you know, the abuse of women and children for sexual parties and stuff? I seem to recall that recently. It came out and it was quashed almost immediately.
I did not see that. I mean, there was the Halliburton case, mm-hmm. where a woman was raped,
right,
by her colleagues, and it was brought out that she had signed there was a clause in her contract that said that she couldn't snitch on her colleagues if they raped her or something to that effect. And it was kind of interesting. Number of Republican politicians voted with Halliburton on that particular issue.
Well, Nick, we could go on for a while. There's all kinds of stuff. Your book opens up so many different avenues of inquiry for me. As you know from my own books, you know, I mean, it just dovetails really nicely with some of the stuff that I've been looking at. And your research technique and your documentation is impeccable. I think that our listeners, I agree with Whitley, what he said, that, you know, go out and get the book and get more than one. Send one to your congressman. You know, you demand that this be investigated more fully and demand that this kind of practice be stopped. I don't know how we can stop it. I don't know who's going to have the strength or, you know, the moral courage to do it, but I mean, this is evil. You can read books about, you know, satanic cults, and you can read The Exorcist or watch a Freddy Krueger film. That's nothing when it compares to what goes on within the covers of the Franklin scandal. We were talking with Nick Bryant, the author of The Franklin Scandal, The Story of Power Brokers, Child Abuse and Betrayal, published by Trine Day. You can look at go to Nick's website, which is franklinscandal.com. Is that right?
Yes.
And look for more information there. This is the definitive text. Everything you've heard about the Franklin scandal is probably true, and there's more of it than you even suspected. So I strongly urge our listeners to take a look at this book and to have your eyes opened as to what's been going on around you. Nick, thanks a lot. It's been long overdue, our talk, and I hope we can do it again soon.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Thank you. And that's all from Peter Lavenda for Unknown Country.